I went to undergrad at the University of Texas, as some of you know, and I was an English and history major, so I wrote a lot of papers. I often like to write papers while I was watching a movie, because that's the logic of a 20-year-old. And so at one point, I was sitting there writing a paper on my laptop, probably watching Jaws for the fifth time that day, and drinking a coffee, and I spilled my coffee on my computer. And I was like, panic, you get up, you get towels, wipe it all down. Okay, and I found out at the end, the next day, there were 9 keys that didn't work. The computer worked fine, but there were 9 keys, including like B and L and some usually important letters in the English language. So the rational thing to do, right? The rational thing to do is try and get your computer fixed. And go like, okay, I'm going to call a help desk, I'm going to go to a center, I'll call someone who knows these things. Did I do that? No. There's this other, the other option that nobody, I'd never known about until I got into that position, is every letter, every character on a computer has what's called an ASCII number that references it. And so ASCII stands for American Standard Code for Information Interchange. And so since every letter, including uppercase and lowercase, so they're different ones. And so what I did is I learned the ASCII number for every key that didn't work. And so every time I had to type B, it would be function 243 if it was lowercase. And then if it was uppercase, it'd be a different one. I wasn't even clever enough to not use a lot of B words in my sentences. But what... The issue was I had an anxiety about using a phone call. I had an anxiety, a fear. I had a fear about going to a help desk and someone making fun of me for spilling coffee, which they probably should have, but I didn't want that to happen. So instead of confronting what I didn't want to face, I found the most onerous way around possible to do it. And I did success. About 2 months later, I realized I could just plug in another keyboard, and that worked just as fine. But usually when we're afraid of something, we don't think rationally. We don't think fully about what we should be doing. And we don't often respond well to external opinions about what we should be doing. We're not in the best place to receive advice in that place. That's why oftentimes, like, kids who are thinking about where to go to college don't often hear the amazing advice you have for them about life, that I have for them. They don't listen to me about what they should do with their life, because they're worried about, you know, wording things, life, everything that comes on. So addressing fears has been something that has happened, that Christians have been dealing with for a long time. The early church father, John of Damascus, put together what he called six species of fear. And so 6 categories of fear is another way to put it. And they are laziness, shamefacedness, shame, amazement, stupor, and anxiety. And I'm Thomas Aquinas kind of goes into this a little. So I'm going to read from the Prima Secunda question 1 through 70. I can be very ostentatious with this because I don't hold it the high way. Okay. So I'll read this through and to explain these 6 species because I think they're very helpful for us to think about. When we think about being afraid. First, there is the toil that burdens our nature, and hence arises laziness, as when a person shrinks from work for fear of doing too much toil. And this, I think, is actually what happened to me, is I was being lazy and ended up doing more work. I didn't want to do one thing, so I ended up having to do like 10 other things in order to avoid that thing. Laziness is not about doing less. It's about not doing what you need to do. And that's often important. Usually we think of laziness as the person just sitting on the couch doing nothing. That's not the lazy person. The lazy person is the person avoiding what they need to be doing. Second, there is the disgrace which damages a person in the opinion of others. And thus, if a disgrace is feared in a deed yet to be done, it is shamefacedness. If, however, it is a deed already done, it is shame. This is a distinction he makes that we don't often use, but I think is very helpful. Shamefacedness is something that hasn't happened yet, but you think is going to happen. Because there's a difference between that than something that has happened. Oftentimes, the things we think are going to happen never happen at all. And we just think about all these ways that we can be ashamed or watch out. And it's all this, like, in our head, we just create it out of fear of what people are going to think, what people are going to say. But that's another thing, another species of fear. The next is by reason of magnitude. Fear by reason of magnitude. When, that is to say, a person considers some great event, the outcome of which he or she is unable to gauge, then there is amazement. Amazement. Not all responses to fear are bad. And I think we need to remember this, that an absence of fear is what's called foolhardiness. It's you rush into battle without thinking what's going to happen. You rush into a situation not having understood what you actually should be afraid of. That's what courage is. Courage is knowing the right fear. Foolhardiness is being fearless. And we don't want to do that. We don't need to do that. There is amazement to be found. The next is by reason of being unwanted, because when some unwanted evil arises before us, and on that account is great in our estimation, then there is stupor. And there's a great difference between amazement and stupor. And just being, that's my impression of stupor. Whereas, like, amazement is, wow. Stupor is, okay. That's all the voice acting and face acting. And finally, the last one is by reason of being unforeseen, thus future misfortunes are feared. And the fear of this kind is called anxiety. So oftentimes, when we think about fears, that's usually the one that comes up. We think it's just anxiety, but there's many other responses that we have that can kind of guide us, and not in that great way. Most of these are bad, but not all of them. Most of the time that we are afraid, it is not this great thing that we respond to. But like with presumption, our task of letting is to let go of the bad fears and hold on to the good one. Hold on to the amazement of God. Hold on to something beyond which we cannot comprehend. I'm not a big fan of scary movies. Some of you might be, I don't know, but I think that's a big part of it. With the allure of scary movies is this amazement. This something terrible is happening, but it's not happening to me. And you get this endorphin rush of these things going on, and then at the end, you're like, oh, it's okay. I can go home. And life is okay. There's this amazement going on. Alina and I tried to go see a movie, a scary movie, a few weeks ago. We went to go see the movie Get Out. And it was during the day. On Friday, I usually have the day off, and so we went to a movie, and we were really excited, and we got about 10 minutes in, and got a phone call from the child care center that our son Dominic was throwing up. So we got our money back. It was the cheapest date we've ever had. We couldn't really test to see if we like scary movies as much anymore. When we come to the image of the Valley of Dry Bones, there are a lot of fears that can pop into your head. Am I in that valley? Am I in that valley? Is someone I love in that valley? How did all those bones get there? I want us to go to that valley for a little bit, to imagine it, to let us see the bones as the prophet saw them. On the cover of your bulletin is an image by Doré, a woodcut of Ezekiel 37, of the Valley of Dry Bones, which is pretty darn neo-Gothic in its structure and the way it's presented, but it's not a pleasant sight. This shouldn't be. Many of you in Texas have been hunting before, have found dead animals on the side of the road, have found bones on the side of the road. I think human bones would be different. You have a different reaction, a visceral reaction of what is going on, of why it is taking place, of what it can possibly mean. Seeing the skulls, seeing the femurs and the tibias and the ribs. And this is the image the prophet presents, that God presents to the prophet. Scholars don't think there's an actual physical place that Ezekiel was imagining. That there's not this valley in Israel that used to have a lot of dry bones, and now it doesn't. But it is an image that God presents to him, and Ezekiel presented to the people. And through Ezekiel presented to us, a valley of dry bones. Dry bones means they've been there a long time. They've been there a long time, and yet they haven't been covered up. They haven't been covered up by rain, by erosion. They're still there. They're waiting. The theologian Karl Barth says that Ezekiel 37 points us back to the beginning of creation. He writes that Ezekiel 37 is thus the most powerful commentary on Genesis 2. On Genesis 2, when God creates Adam and Eve, Adam out of the dust of the earth. And this climax is the end which always threatened and has now come. So we see all these bones going on, but one thing obviously was not killed, it did not die, and is not dead in this valley, and that is the prophetic spirit by whom this people had become a nation. You see, right before Ezekiel 37, in Ezekiel 36, God presents to the prophet this amazing call. I will take you from the nations, I will gather you from all the countries, and I will bring you to your own fertile land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, I will cleanse you of all idols. This is in the exile. The people aren't in their home. This is generations after they have grown up in a strange land. And God is saying that God will bring them back, will purify them, will make them holy, will cleanse them. But then we get this valley. It doesn't look very cleansing, right? It's so easy to look at it and be afraid. It's so easy to see the way that God is cleansing the people as something to be afraid of. But we must hold on to that spirit. The spirit of prophecy with Ezekiel was the spirit at creation that moved over the dark water. It was the spirit of prophecy was the spirit that promised a return from exile. That exile was not the end of the story. It was the spirit sent to Mary saying that you are with child. It is the spirit descended at the baptism of Jesus, the spirit that proceeded from the Father and the Son before creation. The spirit that is the perfect love of the Father to the Son. Perfect love casts out all fear. Not my perfect love, though. Christ's perfect love. Perfect love casts out all fear because Christ casts out the cause of all fear. And the cause of all fear is sin and death. Yet it is so important to remember that in the valley of dry bones, it is not just the souls that rise, it is the bones themselves. The sinews that are formed on the bones. The tombs that are opened. And the bodies that are rising up. Jesus did not just rise in spirit, but in body. And we shall not rise in spirit alone, but in body. Eschatology is a big word for the study of last things. Our eschatological future, our last and final future, is not a set of disembodied souls floating around. It is resurrection. It is new creation. This is what the scriptures say. We are not going to float around in a cloudy Mount Olympus or wander the fields of Elysium or salute in the meat halls of Valhalla. That is not our ultimate goal as Christians. We shall be in a world made new by God. And we see this in the resurrection of Christ. Yet when Jesus rises, he shows his scars to his disciples. As it says in the Gospel of John, it was still the first day of the week that evening while the disciples were behind closed doors because they were afraid. And Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And after this, he showed them his hands and his side. His scars were still with him in resurrection. Our scars are not going to be erased from us. Our scars are not going to be erased from us. Our scars are not our impairments nor our deficiencies. They are marks of our experience of this life. God does not erase who we are and where we have been. That is not our story. Instead, perfect love casts out any fear in ourselves, because we cannot fear in the presence of perfect love. We let go of fear when we let go of saving ourselves, of not thinking that we are worth saving. That is when we let go of fear. We let go of fear when we hold on to the one who frees us. And we can't do this passively. Thus, as we are going to be resurrected with our bodies, we are going to cling to Jesus with our bodies. By clinging to Jesus at the table together today, by clinging to Jesus in worship, by clinging to Jesus in service, in the works of mercy, by clinging to Jesus and sharing Jesus with others. Next week is Palm Sunday. We will cling to who we think Jesus is and celebrate his entry, his triumphant entry into Jerusalem. Next week, we must let go of our pride in order to find out who Jesus really is and what we must do in order to follow him all the way to the cross. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.